All right, welcome everyone to History of Israel Part 1, a 13-part series sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz. The Ili Nishmas Yonah Ben Rav Arya Leib. So I want to thank them for the sponsorship and welcome everyone. So just by way of general introduction, it's an overview of the history of modern Israel, and I hope to elaborate on a number of themes, to shatter some myths, certainly the Arab myth, which is unfortunately today the dominant narrative in the world, but also some of the Jewish myths. There's the secular Zionist Jewish myth, there's the religious Zionist Jewish myth, a lot of myths, but expose some of the trends that have existed now in the land of Israel for close to 150 years to try to put today's events into some context and understand where we are now and how we got to be where we are now through looking at some of the major personalities and events and ideas in what really is a revolutionary historic movement, the Zionist movement. Really the only nationalistic movement in the world, in the history of the world, that was able to recreate a commonwealth after having been severed from the land some 19 centuries before. There's no other example in history. Now we of course give a basis for it from the Torah and from the Nevi'im, and of course we'll return to that very concept, but I think it's important to understand exactly the flow of events and the beginning until in the springtime we'll arrive at the very day. But to start tonight, I think, with exposing the very first myth that exists as part of the secular Zionist ethos, that the land of Israel was depopulated of Jews until the Zionists returned and reclaimed it in the late 19th century, and at some point ran into the Arabs. So that's false. It's false, and it's demonstrably false, as we'll see. The truth is that there are always Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Always. From the time Yehoshua ben Nun conquered the land, even after the first Churban, Jews remained. So the majority of Jews left after the first Churban. So during the Second Commonwealth, there was a minority of Jews living there, even though it was a sizable population. And after the second Churban, more Jews were exiled. But still Jews remained in the land. If you just think about it, facts that we know but we don't often assimilate in a coherent fashion, the Churban took place, the second Churban, in the year 69 of the Common Era, or 70 of the Common Era, depending on how we count. But in the year 200, the Mishnah was completed by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who lived in Eretz Yisrael. He lived there. So it was a flourishing community there, even after the Churban. And the Talmud Yerushalmi was completed in approximately the year 260. And the Sanhedrin existed in the land of Israel until the year 359, which was the very time that Hillel II, not the famous Hillel that we know, who predated the Churban, but Hillel II issued the calendar, the Luach, that we use until today with all the permutations of the calendar, a leap month every seven times every 19 years, and the alternating months of 29 and 30 days with some flexible months like Kislev, Mar Cheshvan, etc. That calendar that we use until today was issued in 359 by Hillel II as the head of the last Sanhedrin that met in Tveria. So now we're almost three centuries after the Churban, and yet the Sanhedrin is still there. Now the Sanhedrin had to disband because of persecution, very harsh persecution at the hands of the Byzantine Christians. So from the time of the Churban and the Roman persecution, and then when the Christians took over and the Byzantine persecution, it is true that there was no rest for any Jew in the land of Israel. Actually, it hasn't been rest for a Jew in the land of Israel from then until today. But the fact is, there was no rest. And it was very hard, very difficult life, but still Jews remained. There remained so much that there was one brief spurt in the 470s when the Byzantine emperor named Julian the Apostate, so-called because he renounced Christianity, befriended the Jews who supported him, and issued a decree permitting the Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash in the year 474. Unfortunately, he died within 2 years. He was overthrown by other empires, so as we know, it didn't happen. But nonetheless, Jews were there. And as much as the Romans tried to eradicate the Jewish presence in the land of Israel by changing the place names, the most famous one, of course, is they named the land Palestine, which is a word you won't hear me say that often. Palestine after the Philistines, because they wanted to rewrite history, much like the Arabs do today, rewrite history in order to imply to those who record these things and to the annals of history that there really was no substantive Jewish presence. The land itself is named after the Philistines, and they changed some of the place names, not just Jerusalem, which the name Aliyah Kapitlin never really caught on, but Shechem. Shechem became Nablus. What's Nablus? It's a corruption of Naples. They took some cities in Italy and just used those names in the land of Israel. The Romans tried to erase the Jewish presence, but they could not. One reason they could not was because there were always Jews there. Nonetheless, the relentless persecution by the Christians ended productive Jewish life in the 4th and 5th centuries, although scattered communities always remained. When the Muslims conquered the land of Israel in 632, which is roughly 150 years after Julian the Apostate, there were Jews there, and the Jews who bore the brunt of the wrath of Muhammad for not accepting his new Torah, his new religion. Nonetheless, the Jews remained. At this point, I should mention that from the year 632 until 1917, except for almost two centuries of Crusader rule, the land of Israel was controlled by Muslims. Muslims of different stripes and from different parts of the Arab world. Umayyads first, and then Mamluks, and finally from 1517 on by Turks until the British came and conquered in 1917. Right in the middle of that period, you had the Crusader conquest. Now, the custom in the ancient world was that when you conquered something, it was yours, and you tried to redraw the map and redraw the religious aspects of the land. The nomenclature changed, the house of worship changed, everything changed. When the Crusaders came, and they conquered Jerusalem, so they also conquered the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock is a very ancient building, goes back to the 7th century. But in 1100, the Crusaders made it into a church. And when the Muslims returned at the end of the 13th century, they reconverted it, so to speak, back into the shrine that it is. Same thing with the Marsa Machpelah, which was made into a church as well, and then became a mosque again when the Arabs took it back. Crusaders landed in 1099, in Akko. At the time, there were 50 different Jewish communities in the land of Israel. They were very cruel, very harsh. To this day, I cringe when I hear someone use the word crusader as a positive description. Among the things they did, they gathered the Jews of Yerushalayim into one shul and burned the shul down with the Jews inside. A precursor of what the Nazis would do dozens of times during the Holocaust. The Jews of Haifa fought for 1 month against the Crusaders, who were very powerful, and they were massacred as well. But they remained. The Jews remained subservient to the Christians as they had been subservient to the Muslims. Something else remained, as we know. The land of Israel is marked by Crusader fortresses until today, that you can visit. Famous ones in Akko, in Caesarea, Nimrod's castle in the Galilee, not to mention Beaufort's castle in the South Lebanon. What the Crusaders built as defensive fortresses remained. Some of these places became central points or targets or bases in subsequent wars for centuries until the wars of the 20th century as well. The Crusaders were gone by 1267. They were routed by the Muslims. Something else happened in 1267. That's when the Muslims issued a decree barring the Jews from entering the Marasa Machpelo. That was the famous decree of the seven steps. They could only ascend seven steps on the outside wall of the Marasa Machpelo, but not enter. That decree lasted exactly 700 years, from 1267 until 1967, when Israel conquered Hebron and reopened Marasa Machpelo. And we'll get to a different time. The very first act, the second act, Rav Gaon blew the shofar in Hebron is the first act, but the second act that happened in Hebron is Moshe Dayan himself came and blew up those seven steps. And if you visit the Marasa Machpelo as you walk up, before you turn left to go into the entrance of the Marasa Machpelo, if you walk straight up to the point where the wall reaches a right angle, you see the remnants of those steps on the outside of the Marasa Machpelo, which the Jews could use for only seven, which the Jews could use for those 700 years. Now, there's no doubt Jewish life was dormant, but it was still alive. And this never changed for 1900 years. It was an overwhelmingly, for centuries, almost an exclusively religious population, but it has to be said that they lived in tremendous poverty, hardship that it's hard for us to put into words. I'm talking now in medieval times, but we'll see in a few moments, it existed in the 1800s as well. But dire poverty, rampant disease, which they had no way of quelling. Hardship, both financial and political. They were subservient to Muslims who barely tolerate minorities, and they were subject to constant marauding, constant attacks, pogroms, without any central government. One of the unique features of Eretz Yisrael until our time was that it was always governed by foreign potentates. That is to say, there was no central government. The Umayyads, the Mamluks, the Turks were all based elsewhere. Israel, the land of Israel, never became even a regional capital for any of these rulers. It was a backwater. It was something that had significance to Muslims, but they never made it into a central aspect of Islamic life until about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when Israel took it over. So then it became a more substantive Islamic fiefdom, holy territory. It wasn't holy for 1,300 years until the Jews came. Now, notwithstanding the poverty and the disease and the persecution and the hardship, Jews always came. And this we know famously, but I want to create a thread, a continuity between the Jews of the Churban until the Jews of today. So for example, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Kuzari, came in the 1140s. It's a famous legend. He was killed when he came to Yerushalayim, stomped on by an Arab on horseback. Well, it's true enough, we don't know, but the fact is he was there, he came. In fact, he issued, already in the 1130s, a call for Aliyah, time to come back. I suppose finding the Crusader influence at the time a more benign one than the Muslim influence. The Rambam came a few decades later, but stayed a very short time because he saw the hardship and could not withstand the difficulties there. In 1210, think about it. In 1210, 300 rabbis came from England and France to give chizuk to the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, and they stayed. Echoes of our time. They just picked themselves up. They heard the community of Eretz Yisrael need spiritual guidance. They're suffering in the year 1210, and it wasn't, you know, travel then. It wasn't like travel today. They didn't have to go through the magnometers and the research, couldn't take liquids. No, it was a long and arduous and difficult journey, and yet they made it. The Ramban came in 1267 and found two Jews, a dyer and his son, living in Yerushalayim. He revived the city, brought more Jews in, built a famous shul that existed almost 700 years till the Jordanians destroyed it. There was always traffic, always commerce, always learning, for centuries. In the 16th century, there was a tremendous revival of Jewish life in the land of Israel. the indigenous Sephardic community was bolstered by many Spanish exiles who by and large went to Italy and Turkey, some to North Africa, and a good number of them came to continue the journey, came to the land of Israel. One of the most famous Spanish exiles, Rabbi Yosef Caro, was born in Spain in 1488, just 4 years before the expulsion. So he wound up in Sfat after living much of his life in Constantinople. He wound up in Sfat, there in Sfat in the 1560s, he completed the Shulchan Aruch. So again, if we think of the land of Israel as nothing happening from the Churban until 1948 or 1897, 1881, the first Aliyah, we're missing a lot. The Shulchan Aruch was written in Eretz Yisrael. The Ari HaKadosh was a contemporary of the Mechaber. He died also in the early 1260s. He wasn't there that long with the Ari. He was in Sfat less than 2 years, maybe a year and a half. And the Ari died very young. I think he was 37, 38 when he died. A tremendous influence. Old school of Kabbalah arose around him. Moshe Cordovero in Sfat. Every Friday night we sing L'Chadodi, Shlomo Alkabetz. He lived in Sfat in this time as well. They're all contemporaries. I should mention, apropos of nothing in particular, but Rabbi Yosef Kahl wrote a Sefer Shaios and Shuvos called Avkas Rochel. One of the things he writes in the Avkas Rochel is that because the communities were flourishing, there were almost 20,000 Jews in Sfat in his time, Jews from the exile came to celebrate Yom Tov for the Regalim, much like Jews do today. And Rabbi Yosef Kahl recorded the Jews from the exile came, and forgive me for saying it, they held 2 days, the public minyanim on the second day of Yom Tov that the Jews in the exile worship, and nobody complained. It added something to the flavor of the observance of Yom Tov, and that's what it was. There was a flourishing Jewish community in Gaza at the time, in the 1500s, with a series of chief rabbis. To us, the most famous is Rabbi Yisrael Najara, who was in Gaza maybe 15 years before he went back to Damascus. Famous poet, among other things, wrote Kari Bon Olam, the Zemer we sing Friday night. But that was in Gaza. In fact, Rabbi Yisrael Najara eventually returned to Gaza, and he's buried in an ancient Jewish cemetery not far from the destroyed town of Nitzarim, where Rabbi Yisrael Najara was buried. So all these places had very deep Jewish roots. Maybe the most fascinating aspect of this time, because there's other things that are more widely known, was the first Jewish political settlement in the land of Israel that was sponsored and governed from afar by Yosef Nasi. Yosef Nasi may be better known to you as the nephew of Doña Gracia Nasi, the famous conversa, who was very wealthy and influential. And her nephew became an international banker as well, and he fostered very close ties with Suleiman the okay. He called himself Suleiman the Magnificent, but I don't take well to that title. Suleiman the Magnificent was all built the walls around the old city of Yerushalayim. So he fostered very close ties with Suleiman, and then there was a contested succession when Suleiman died, between two of his sons, being a very bitter civil war, and Yosef Nasi supported the winner, his son Salim, supported financially, lending him money so he'd be able to triumph over his brother, which he did. And in gratitude, Salim made him a duke, gave him a little godforsaken island in the Mediterranean called Naxos. So Yosef Nasi became the Duke of Naxos, which meant nothing to him or to anyone else. But Yosef Nasi said he wants land in Eretz Yisrael. And Salim gave him a concession over the city of Tveria and the surrounding towns. So if you think about it, from the 4th to the 19th centuries, the only Jewish political settlement in the land of Israel was that founded by Yosef Nasi. Tveria was under Jewish municipal control, the Jewish town. And it founded after his death in 1579, but it did exist. Now, by the end of the 16th century, the Turks started a long decline which really hasn't ended yet. They're still heading down. Every time they think they can't go lower, somehow they manage as well. By the 1700s, the Turks were reeling, and different nations, both east and west of them, were carving off different portions, so they were ripe for attack, the Ottoman Empire was, and Napoleon decided to feast on some of their remainders, and he attacked Israel as well. Napoleon is a very interesting character. He promised, besides trying to start a Sanhedrin, which is a separate topic for French Jews, Napoleon promised the Jewish community in Israel that they would have their own state if he won. Naturally, typically, the Jews chose the wrong side, and they supported the Turks out of loyalty, whatever reason. Loyalty, even though these people had been persecuting them for 300 years, they got used to it. So, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Despite centuries of mistreatment, the Jews supported the Turks against Napoleon. In Yerushalayim, the chief rabbi then, Rabbi Yom Tov Al-Ghazi, led prayers for the Turks. Napoleon entered the land of Israel. He avoided attacking Yerushalayim because it was a walled city, it'd be more difficult, and he wanted first to lay siege to the city by conquering the surrounding towns. So he did conquer Yafo. He besieged Akko on Shabbos Zohar in the year 1799. By some strange coincidence, Reb Nachman of Breslov was in Akko at the time, the famous Reb Nachman, who had no successor. He also supported the Turks. He escaped. He cursed Napoleon. And in fact, Napoleon failed to conquer the land of Israel, which was one of his first defeats, and was downfall from there. We say he met his Waterloo in Akko. They don't say that. Eventually, his troops faltered in Moscow in 1812, and Napoleon was gone from the scene 2 years later. But by 1800, there are 15,000 Jews approximately living in Israel. But again, the numbers were kept low. The Ottoman Empire restricted immigration to the land of Israel. It was, again, terrible poverty. They really had no source of income. The persecution was relentless. Nonetheless, as a Jesuit priest wrote in 1674, something which would be even more true in the 19th century and then parts of the 20th century. He said, Jews pay heavily to the Turk for their right to stay here. They prefer being prisoners in Jerusalem to enjoying the freedom they could acquire elsewhere. And that would become the mantra of the old Yishuv, the Jewish community in Yerushalayim in the 19th and the 20th centuries. And the fact is, that mentality you see in our day as well, in Yesha. They could live very well in places which are less dangerous, but nonetheless they prefer being prisoners to a certain extent, in their homes, behind walls, behind fences, but knowing that building, developing the land of Israel, then enjoying complete freedom they could have elsewhere, all because of Avas Eretz Yisrael and to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. 1808, a very important year, then many of the Talmidim of the Gaon Mivilna came to Eretz Yisrael, first to Tzfat, and then to Yerushalayim. Now, already in the 1700s, many followers of the Baal Shem Tov had come, including the Baal Shem Tov's own brother-in-law, Reb Gershon Kitover. He came and lived in Eretz Yisrael. But the Groz disciples, when they moved into Yerushalayim, right away they clashed with the Sephardi establishment, all things, again, which recur ad hayom. There was a Sephardi establishment. Most, if not all, the people there were Sephardim. They had their own court system. They had a Chacham Bashi, a chief rabbi, appointed with the approval of the Ottomans. So they were the governing body of Jews in Israel. And the Groz Talmidim, the Groz was dead. The Groz died in 1797. But the Groz Talmidim did not want to be beholden to them, so they imposed their views not only on the community in which they lived, but ad hayom. When I say ad hayom, often we speak of Minhag Eretz Yisrael, things which differ somewhat from what we do here. They say Sim Shalom at Mincha every day. They don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. A number of dozens of minhagim like that. Minhag Eretz Yisrael is less than 200 years old. The Talmidim of the Gra came, and they said, this is what we're doing. And those became the minhagim of the land of Israel until today. they greatly expanded the Jewish presence in Yerushalayim, and they formed already in the 1820s, 1830s, what they called Hayishuv Hayashan, the old yishuv, the old settlement, later to be contrasted with the new yishuv, which came in the 1880s, 1890s, and about 90 years after they started the Yeshuv HaYashan, that metamorphosed into what's known today as the Eda HaCharedis. Now, by 1840, keep in mind, 1840 is 20 years before Herzl was born. According to the Turkish census, the Jews were already a majority in Yerushalayim in 1840. In 1840 also, Reb Shmuel Salant came from Lithuania. Within a year or so, he was appointed the Rav of Yerushalayim, and that started the tradition, by the way, of having a Sephardic chief rabbi of cities, or the country generally, and an Ashkenazic chief rabbi. So he became the Rav of Yerushalayim. He served for 60 years, which is about 40 years longer than I can imagine anyone staying in a rabbinate in one place, but he was there for 60 years. And they maintained a foothold, and they built they built a religious infrastructure that in many ways exists until today. Now, these were the Jews that were there. Their community, the communities that existed already from the 1500s on in Yerushalayim, in Hebron, in Tzfat. Tzfat was destroyed by an earthquake in 1837, which caused many of the survivors to move to Yerushalayim. Akko, Tveria, Caesarea, El Arish, Shechem, Gaza, and dozens of other communities that exist in the land of Israel already from the early 1500s. Now, there were two facets of life that they grew accustomed to. One was the marauding bands that just came, swept through, whether Bedouins or Arab brigands from other countries that came through. There are other Arabs there as well. We'll get to that in a subsequent lecture. But at the time, they were mainly Bedouins, itinerants, transients. They weren't any large Arab communities. They didn't live like that. Ramla, by the way, already existed as a community for centuries before this. The second feature of life, which was common, again, until today, is that they relied almost exclusively on support from abroad. So the notion of having the Shulachim go out to raise money for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, that existed for centuries before our day. Maybe they perfected it in our day, I don't know, but it is no different. What the Yeshuv HaYashan called Chalukah, Chalukah means the Jews in the exile give a share of what they have to support the Jews in the land of Israel, that existed for centuries. Already in the 1700s, the Chidah, the famous Chidah, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, famous Sephardi, he became a world traveler going out to raise money. He was a mashulach. He raised money for yeshivas in Hebron, Yerushalayim, and when he left, he never came back. Somehow, he was able to transfer the funds back to Israel. But he went as far as London, all through Europe, made his way finally to London, and on his way back, stopped in Livorno, Leghorn, on the west coast of Italy, and there he died, there he was buried, until he was repatriated some 30 years ago, his body was brought back to Israel. But even the great Chidah is a very prolific writer, by the way, dozens and dozens of Sfarim. He was Mashulach. He went out raising money for the Jewish community in the land of Israel. And this is also worth mentioning. The population was almost exclusively Shomer Mitzvahs. Almost exclusively Shomer Mitzvahs. When the Zionists did come in the late 19th century, secular, many of them, especially 1890s and 1900s, socialist and anti-Torah, it was a tremendous culture shock. It's as if they didn't know what hit them. That animosity lingers until today, and that conflict between the old Yishuv and the established Jews, who had never seen a Jew eat tray, be Michal Shabbos, not wear tefillin, and the new Jews who came, that earthquakes, aftershocks, after effects, are still felt today. And you see it in all these issues that arise, like the parade last month that didn't take place. all these issues are really no different than things that happened 60 and 80 and 100 and 120 years ago. It's the exact same thing, the cause changes. But the conflict, the clash remains. And that culture shock is something also that we'll discuss later on, because it affects the way Jews perceive modern Israel, and it affects many other things today as well. Now, at a certain time, there was a religious awakening. Now, we're all religious people, so we have no doubt that the religious awakening is motivated from above, and part of that religious awakening is the reaction that Jews have to certain trends that exist in the non-Jewish world. And there's also a staple of Jewish life that we don't like to admit to as often as we should, but there's a Yiddish expression that as the Christians do, so the Jews do. And in fact, that happened. Europe was beset in the 19th century with a wave of nationalism in country after country. France, especially in the 1840s, forget the French Revolution in the 1790s, 1840s, 1850s, there were revolutions in France, in Germany, in the Balkans, and for some reason, a very powerful influence was the revolution in Italy in 1859, which served to coalesce and make Italy into one country, or almost one country. Italy, until then, was just divide up into different fiefdoms with the dukes here, there, Tuscany here, and this, that, and the Papal States. A revolution took place that effectively united Italy, including Sicily. There's a separate revolution in Sicily that then carried over to the mainland. That was led by Garibaldi, who's a figure famous to us because he was a tremendous influence on Menachem Begin. Because Sicily had every reason to be separate. It's an island off the coast of Italy. And nonetheless, he presided over a reunification. So by 1860, the entire dynamic of Italy had changed, and Europe as well. Not to mention the Austro-Hungarian Empire was suffering the effects of Balkan nationalism, which also really hasn't subsided until today. Although now in the 1990s, the world became wise enough to say if they want to be separate autonomous entities, Bosnia, Montenegro, Serbia, etc., let them. Why have them fight for so long? Let them go their separate ways. And in fact, that's what happened. Torah says, Nashiras Hazinu, Yatsev V'lo Samim U'mispar B'nei Yisrael, that God arranges the borders of nations in accordance with the numbers of Jews, meaning the needs of Jews. And this is a powerful influence, a very powerful influence. If the most powerful influence on Zionism was Jew hatred, rampant Jew hatred, which even the emancipation and enlightenment did nothing to quell, as we'll discuss more next week, then the second most powerful influence, if not even slightly more powerful than that, was the rise of nationalism. Because then, in a small group of Jews scattered about, not necessarily even knowing each other, religious Jews, there arose the thought, if Frenchmen and Italians and Germans and Serbs can gather together and make a homeland for themselves, so why can't Jews? Why can't Jews? The very first person to articulate these ideas was a Jew named Rav Yehuda Alkalai, who was born in 1798. He was a Svardi, born in Sarajevo, raised in Yerushalayim. His parents made Aliyah in the early 1800s, but he returned to be the Rav in Serbia. Not such a good shteller, but he went to be the Rav in Serbia, which of course was a hotbed of nationalist sentiment. He began, so the Sfardim of course spoke Ladino. He began teaching his students Hebrew. He wrote his first book in 1839 called Darchei Noam, which is a Hebrew-Ladino textbook, but therein, in the midst of the textbook, he inserted certain ideas, propounding the notion that the Geula is not passive. Redemption is not passive, but redemption needs preparation. And just like there's tshuva of an individual, a tshuva, the repentance of an individual is from sin, there's such a thing as the tshuva of a nation. What's tshuva of a nation? He said literally, lashuv, not to repent, but to return. tshuva of Klal Yisrael is Shivat Zion. And this he wrote in already 1839. And he advocated two ideas, that the Jews of Europe buy land in Israel, and they return and settle there, and they revive the Hebrew language as their vernacular, as their common everyday tongue, so that when they do return to Israel, we would be one nation. Those two ideas, he wrote in this book in 1839, and the reaction of the Jews of Europe was scorn, ridicule. He had misstated our philosophy on Geula. It's disloyal to our host countries to say our homeland should be any place but where we live now. To that he wrote a response, this time not in Ladino, but in Hebrew, in 1843, called Minchas Yehuda, wherein he reiterated his ideas. Again, he called upon the Jews to make Aliyah, return to Israel, buy land, work the land, and especially, think about it now, it was 1843, he called upon the Jews to wake up and learn the lesson of the 1840 Damascus blood libel. So that was a very famous, world-shaking event. Jews were accused, of course, of using the blood of an Arab child to bake matzos. The head of Syria then was a fellow named Mustafa Ali, a vicious Jew hater, and two Jews were sentenced to death, and this provoked a worldwide outcry, including American Jews getting involved the very first time, including a mission that was dispatched by President Martin Van Buren, of all people, to Damascus to plead on behalf. Eventually the Jews were freed, and it showed Jews the power that Jews could have if they unite and speak up, especially in a moral cause. But nonetheless, Rav Alkalai wrote, learn the lesson of the Damascus blood libel, the Golos is going to end, that there's no hope. There's no hope in Europe, there's no hope in Arabia. Learn the lesson, it's 100 years before the Holocaust. Well, Rav Yehuda Alkalai had very, very limited effect on his generation. Even though his book, Minchas Yehuda, was translated into a number of languages, including English, he himself then, for the rest of his life, raised funds for agricultural settlements, which we'll discuss in a few moments. He felt was the way to build Israel. He moved back to Yerushalayim in 1874, where his ideas of work and farming and building were vehemently opposed by the old Yishuv. And there he died in Yerushalayim in 1878. Now again, if you just think back and compare it to today, it's really not changed. The old Yishuv was insistent on maintaining a certain way of life that revolved exclusively around Torah study and menial labor and primarily support from abroad. Any type of industry, for that matter, any type of settlement outside Yerushalayim was anathema. Anything which would take people away from hardcore Talmud Torah as the focus of life was a betrayal of why there in Eretz Yisrael. And again, think back to what that priest said. They preferred that type of life in Yerushalayim just to bask in the air of holiness, even if the lives were difficult and they were penurious. It made no difference to them. So that clash also existed in a number of areas, not just related to work, later on to army service, but also to secular studies in schools, v'chulei. So another great Jew had similar ideas, greater impact. Strange to say, he didn't know Rav Alkalai until very late in life because of the way communication was at that time. And that's the famous Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. So he was born in 1795 in Lisa, in the Posen district of Poland. He was a Rav in Poland and Germany. He was the Talmud of the Nesivos, Rabbi Yaakov Lorbebaum, wrote the Nesivos Mishpat and Chashan Mishpat, also Talmud of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He adopted the Shitas Hagra, that redemption will not just suddenly come down from heaven, but rather redemption must first be engaged by human endeavor. Now that motivator of Alkalai and motivated Sefirot Kalasher, and in fact motivated all the religious Zionists. To some degree, it motivated also people in the old Yishuv, except for one thing. The counter-argument to that, then as now, that standard was always borne by the Hungarians. The Hungarians adopted what was known to us as an eschatological passivity. You can't do anything. You have to sit back, don't do anything. Rav Tzvirosh Kalischer embraced similar ideas to Rav Alkalai, settlement, farming. He was even more radical. He wrote in his Sefer that you can restore korbanos. You don't need the Beis HaMikdash for korbanos. As long as you figure out where the Mizbeach was, that would suffice. That idea alone, that you could have the reinstitution of korbanos, made him a radical and made him very controversial. In 1862, he published a sefer called Drishat Sion. Now, the name itself was taken from Pasuk, the Gemara notes, Sion he Doresh Ein Lo. The Gemara says, Michlal the Bayo Drisha. Drishat Sion, seeking Zion, searching for Zion. If the Pasuk says, Sion, Doresh Ein Lo, there's no one to inquire after it, Michlal, we see from here that you need someone to inquire after Tzion, and he became the great inquirer after Tzion. Drishat Tzion was reprinted just a few years ago by Mossad Rav Kook. It's very sharp, very telling, a scathing criticism of Jews. And you know how well Jews like scathing criticism, or criticism of any type. He acknowledged the nationalist sentiment that was coursing through Europe at the time, and you could tell it bothered him as a Jew and as a human being that such sentiment did not exist amongst Jews. I'll read you just a brief passage. He says, Gam b'nei Yisrael anashim asher ruach b'hen l'drosh l'chadesh nachlas avosayim. Jews are also men, we're also people that should have a spirit to inquire after and to renew the heritage of our fathers. Eretz HaMekudeshes HaShomeimo Babzuyo, the land which is holy, but nonetheless desolate and despised. Lasum Aleh Kitzon Adam HaMlechol Afrit Tiyeh V'Hitzi Lasom. Now he asks a powerful question. Loma Anshei Italia, 3 years after the reunification of Italy. Loma anshe Italia, Ushari Medinos, Yimsurum Nafsham Avur Eretz Avosehem. Why do the people of Italy and other countries give their lives for the land of their fathers? Alachas Kame V'chama, Eretz Kazos. So certainly a land like this one, Eretz Yisrael. Asher Koyo Shvei Tevel Kadosh Yomrelel. The whole world calls it the Holy Land. Vanachnu Namod Merachok, Kegever Oyin. We're going to stand at a distance as if we're not men. I overlave ayin, as if we don't have a heart, we don't have any power. Gam anachlu tidruchi nafshenu oz livnos hanashamos lokim anerasos. We also, the same thing, our soul should also be moved. We should develop the inner strength to build and to rebuild that which was destroyed, and to revive that which is desolate. And then he hastens to add, knowing his audience, the Im Kozeh, notwithstanding our love for Israel, the homeland, Lo Yismait Bozeh Avas Toldos Ha'aret Asher Anachnu Shochnim Aleh, that does not diminish at all the love for the lands in which we dwell now. As Yirmiyahu said, Dirshu Ashlomo Yer, you'll seek the peace of the city, God says, to which I'm sending you. You have to be a good citizen of the land of the exile in which you live. But that does not at all contradict the fact that Sion he Doresh Ein Lo. Well, this Sefer Drisha Sion again advocated redemption as a process, not as Jews traditionally saw it. God coming in one fell swoop with Mashiach in tow, with miracles and wonders. This latter attitude, the passive attitude, dominated amongst Hungarian Jewry. But it wasn't really a dominant threat in Jewish life until the Hungarians made it such. if you think about it, that notion of eschatological passivity, strains of it remain until today as well in the Eda Haredis and other parts of the religious community in Israel. Her Tzviras Kalischer had slightly more success than Rav Alkalai. It's all relative. Slightly more success. He became Mishugala Davar. He became very, very passionate. The fact is, the only people who accomplish things in the world are those who are Mishugaim Ladavar. You have to be crazy about it. And he was crazy enough. He traveled around Europe. He met whoever he could meet with. He wrote articles. He wrote pamphlets. He tried to arouse a people that was essentially nationalistically dormant for centuries. It was not an easy task, especially because he was now coming into an environment in the land of Israel in which they got used to a certain political passivity and financial passivity. Forget the Mashiach or Gula business. So he, for example, and Rav Alkalai opposed the Batei Machzah housing project. Batei Machzah, which also exists today, was a poorhouse. It was housing for poor people in the old city, funded from abroad. It was built in the 1860s, and he was against it. The people just come and live there, and they live there in poverty, and it would foster dependency, like a revival of the housing projects of the 1960s. Nothing would come of it. In fact, they were right about it. They, Rav Kalischer, Rav Alkalai, wanted settlements, work, building, tilling the soil, redeeming the land. And that was a very hard sell then, and it wasn't bought. But that notion would reverberate in the Zionist movement when it started to come in the 1890s, and that became a very powerful force, to the extent that for several decades, they almost played down the notion of political revival and focused on building the land, planting and growing, etc. Both men, therefore, enthusiastically supported Mikveh Yisrael. The Mikveh Yisrael was an agricultural school that was founded by French Jews in 1870, not far from Yafo, and both of them planted seeds in different ways and were inspirations on some level for the variety of settlements which took place. And again, at this point, we're talking almost exclusively religious Jews. Three more personalities to think of. Sir Moses Montefiore, famous Jew, lived a very long life, died at 101. He was a Sfardi, was born in Italy. He became well known, of course, as an international banker and stockbroker in London, so wealthy that he retired at the age of 40, which was my fantasy, didn't work out. And after the age of 40, for the next 61 years, he devoted himself to Klal Yisrael. He traveled around the world as a Jewish super diplomat, making, in fact, 7 trips to the land of Israel, the last being at the age of 90. In 1855, responding to the currents then in the Jewish world, small part of the Jewish world, he buys land outside the old city of Yerushalayim. 1855, again, 5 years before Herzl was born. Very controversial. It was considered very modern, a breach of the decorum of Jewish life, destructive of Torah, etc., etc., for the very first Jewish settlement outside the old city of Yerushalayim, which became Mishkanot HaShananim in 1860, still exists today. The land that adjoins it was later called Yamin Moshe, after him, with the famous windmill that provided a meager income for a very, very short period of time. Montefiore did something else, which unfortunately is now lost to our generation. Until his time, Kever Rachel had a little tent over it. He was the one who built the famous dome, the building and the dome over Kever Rachel, which existed in all the pictures. You see old pictures, you think it's from the 1500s. No, it was from the 1860s. And that dome has now been completely overwhelmed by the massive fortress which now envelops Kever Rachel. But he did that. Now, he then began to invest, and that started to lure Jews out of the old city of Yerushalayim into different parts of the country, parts of Yerushalayim also, in order to expand the city and expand opportunities. Yeah, I should mention something. I think I left it out. Yes, you know, by 1840 already, by 1840, Jews were a majority in Yerushalayim. 1840. There were 15,000 people in Yerushalayim in 1840. 8,000 were Jews by the Turkish census. So in fact, the city was already growing. The old city is limited in size until today. In 1869, 7 families moved out of the old city, all Talmidim of the Gro, by that time children and grandchildren of Talmidim of the Gro, and they started, those 7 families, what's called until today, Nachlat Shivo. Nachlat Shivo, which is off the Midrachov, between Kikar Tzion and Rehov HaGron, and those 7 families grew. One of them was Yosef Rivlin, the ancestor of Ruby Rivlin, who was the last speaker of the Knesset. Well, these currents also bore fruit. In the late 1870s, a movement began, which was a mixed movement of religious and secular Jews, but had a very, very dominant religious influence, called Chibat Tzion. Chibat Tzion, lovers of Tzion. The members were called Chovavei Tzion, name of the famous shul in Yerushalayim where they daven Shabbos morning in 48 minutes. They were Chovavei Tzion. So there was an organizational meeting in 1884. The goal was to support Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. Those settlements, we'll see in a moment, already existed, and to encourage Aliyah from Russia to Israel. Now, it had mixed parentage. Its nominal leader was Leon Pinsker. By the way, if nothing else comes out of this lecture, at least the street names in Israel mean a little more to us. So Leon Pinsker, famous to us as Rehov Pinsker in Yerushalayim, he was the head of the Chibat Tzion, but in fact, Rav Kalischer was involved at the very beginning. He died in 1874. The Netziv, from Atelier Tzion of Berlin, or Shivan Volozhin, who was a very, very strong supporter. Many prominent rabbis who wouldn't normally associate with anything Zionist signed letters of support. The Beis Halevi, the first Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, the Malbim, very strong supporters of the Chibat Tzion. And now the issue is on the agenda. But the most powerful force in Chibat Tzion was a great Rav, Rav Shmuel Moaliver of Bialystok, and he had the great vision to enlist the assistance of Baron Edmund de Rothschild. So Rothschild was the grandson of Mayor Amschel Rothschild, who was a firm Jew, yeshiva student, became in the late 1700s one of the wealthiest men in the world, a banker, and he started the famous Rothschild family of bankers. Most of the family was not religious. He and some children and grandchildren were. Today, very few, except maybe for Stuart, very few are today. Some are not even Jews anymore that have the name Rothschild. But he was born in Paris, Edmund de Rothschild, in 1845. Under the influence of Shmuel Moaliver and the Chibat Tzion, he purchased or founded, already in the 1880s, Rishon LeZion, so named because it was Rishon LeZion. And Rosh Pinah, and Metula, Rosh Pinah in the Galil, Metula all the way in the north on the Lebanese border. In the center of the country, Chadera, and Zichron Yaakov. We visited last time, a year ago or 2 years ago, on our trip to Israel. There's a beautiful park in Zichron Yaakov that was paid for by the Rothschild family that has the family logo. Rothschild means red shield. It had a red shield on the home of Mayor Amschel Rothschild in Frankfurt. So there's a red shield over the gateway in the entrance to the park in Zichron Yaakov as a gesture of gratitude, as a sign that it was paid for by the Rothschilds. Started the Carmel Winery, never thinking anything would come of it. He sent over vine cuttings from France because there had been no vines in growing from the ground of Eretz Yisrael for 18 centuries. Those vine cuttings somehow took root, and the Carmel wineries exist until today. In 1878, Petach Tikva was founded as a city, almost exclusively religious Jews. And at this point, in the 1880s, there was a Russian Aliyah we'll discuss next week. At this point, almost the entirety of the land of Israel consists of religious Jews coming back. Some motivated by a desire to further the Geula, some simply because they want to live in the land of Israel and enjoy its holiness, but all of them understanding that something different is happening, something unique in the world, something special in Jewish life. The land itself was a religious land. This would change with the first Aliyah of Russian Jews after the pogroms in Russia in 1881. With all this development, which is all pre-Herzl, Herzl didn't really get involved until the early 1890s, there was one thing that was lacking, and that was what became known as political Zionism. Not just an attempt to live there and support oneself there, but have some political dimension that would lead to the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people. That the old Yishuv was not interested in, that Rothschild and Montefiore, and even at that early stage, Rav Alkalai and Rav Tzvirus Kalischer, never even imagined. For that, we had to wait for the arrival on the scene of Theodor Herzl. Next week, Theodor Herzl and the rise of political Zionism. Thank you very much.